Climacophobia, the fear of climbing stairs. It's surprising there's a term for it, but if you have chronic hip pain, it's easy to relate to. But you shouldn't have to. At the Cedars-Sinai Orthopedic Center, our minimally invasive techniques allow many patients to go back home within 24 hours and get back to everyday tasks, like walking up the stairs. More reasons to trust the number one hospital in LA for joint replacements. Call 1-800-CEDARS-1 or visit our website.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is syndicated columnist Amy Elkon with Advice Goddess Radio. Nerd your way to a better life with the best brains in science. As a writer, I sometimes don't want to talk about what I'm working on. It's kind of like that thing you hear about how some tribes believe a photograph steals their soul. Sometimes talking about what you're writing about, which is basically dreaming aloud, leaves you feeling kind of like you spilled all your energy for writing it out on the floor while you were at that cocktail party or whatever. So you go back to the computer, and then suddenly you're this bloodless, idealist, wordless version of the you who formerly had something to say. It's scary. You just really feel drained. So, and this isn't always the case, but I sometimes feel that way, so I really resist telling people what's about to come out of my keyboard. Now, it turns out this has something in common with dreaming, the dreaming about what you want. And that isn't the positive thing it's always cracked up to be. In fact, as my guest tonight, NYU psychology professor Dr. Gabriel Oettingen points out, the pleasurable act of dreaming seems to let us fulfill our wishes in our minds, sapping our energy to actually do the work to get what we want. Dr. Oettingen's book we'll be discussing tonight is Rethinking Positive Thinking, Inside the New Science of Motivation. Stick with us to benefit from her 20-some years of research on what really motivates us so you can learn realistic and proven steps for improving your health and meeting your goals in your friendships and your relationship and your work. So hello, Gabrielle.
Hello, hello. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I was very excited by your book. It's just the thinking in it is just counterintuitive, but it's so important. It's research-based. And you start the book by talking about how in modern Western societies, we experience what some call the curse of freedom. Now, you're not against freedom. Explain what this means.
Well, I can't explain what freedom is. That would take me a long time.
Oh, no. I meant the curse of freedom.
But what certainly sometimes we feel is that we have so many choices and that we are all alone in paving our path for the future, and that we need to be responsible for what we are actually doing in our lives. And that's sometimes difficult, as much as we like it and as much as it is a privilege to have that freedom. Sometimes it is difficult to find the path, to find the direction of acting, and actually also to find the energy of going then where we actually wish to go.
Right. When you have to carve your own path, it really is harder. And that's why, you know, it's very easy to work for a corporation versus being an entrepreneur, because the corporation, someone assigns you work. You have this office and this desk and this thing that you're supposed to do, rather than, oh, my God, the world is your oyster, which is actually, that can be hard. So I understand what you're saying about the curse of freedom. I want to get into this this dreaming and not doing. It's so interesting. And talk about this notion that simply imagining our deepest wishes coming true will help us attain them. You know, this is everywhere these days, this kind of thinking.
Well, it had been around for a long time, and it is so seductive to think that the pleasurable act of dreaming already brings us there, what we dream about. And so, you know, a lot of trainings and sessions around positive thinking have been very, very successful. No wonder, because it is pleasurable to dream about a positive future, to dream about wish fulfillment. And then if we are told that this is the way to actually achieve these dreams in reality, then it's even more pleasurable. But the fact is that the more positive you dream your desired future to come true, the less likely it is that it actually will come true.
Yeah, this is so amazing. That's a central idea in your book and in your research. And you talk about, though, how there's almost a religion of optimism in our society. You call it the cult of optimism. And you say, given optimism's prevalence and how fondly people look at it, it sometimes feels risky to express even mildly negative viewpoints inside an institution or an organization.
Well, yes, sometimes it is a little tricky to say, you know, what is the obstacle to your dream? What is it that stands in your way? People look at you a little bit kind of estranged and say, you know, what does she ask me these things? Because positive thinking has been around for a long time as the way to go about our lives. But when we sort of started that research long, long time ago, basically 20 years ago, we thought at first as well that positive thinking in whatever form it comes, whether it comes as judgments about the likelihood that certain things will happen in the future, or whether it comes as free dreams and images, that all these positive forms or these forms of positive thinking, that they will have a kind of motivating effect and that this will be beneficial for our action. But then the data taught us that this might not be like that. So I learned from the data which we collected early on.
And now you talk about this, there's a very interesting example in your book about people in communist East Berlin, you know, when you were investigating positive fantasies and how they remained hopeful even when they believed their wishes for the future very likely wouldn't come true.
Right. Now, positive fantasies, you can't say, or positive dreams are not bad. It just needs to be specified for what you want to use them. So if you want to use them for feeling pleasure or for feeling upbeat or for kind of exploring the possibilities in your future, that's perfect. Use them, enjoy them, explore what your possibilities are. Or if you don't have any possibilities of acting anyway, then you can positively fantasize. So, for example, if you handed in an application for, let's say, you apply to a company for a job, and you handed in the application and everything is done now, and it is out of your hands, you might as well positively dream about the success, because you can't do anything anyhow anymore. So when you are in a country or in a situation where you really cannot do anything anymore, then you can positively fantasize, because positive fantasies and dreams are just a little bit problematic if you feel that you need to achieve the future you are dreaming about, if you need to put in a lot of effort to achieve the future that you are dreaming about.
You give a great example of this weight loss study you did with 25 obese female subjects at Penn, and I was so fascinated that women with the strong positive fantasies about slimming down, you know, this think positive thing we're told, they were the ones who pictured themselves looking all slender and attractive. They lost 24 pounds fewer than the people who pictured themselves more negatively. That's an amazing thing. Explain that to us.
Well, the people who positively fantasize about the future, they kind of feel that they're already there. They consume the positive future in their mind. They are happy to enjoy the positive future in their mind. And by doing that, they oversee that it is a hard way to reach the positive future, that there are obstacles and temptations and relinquishment on the way to the positive future. And thus, they kind of get caught then when these difficulties arise. And also, they don't bring up the necessary energy to actually achieve the positive future. So what we find is in many studies that the people who positively fantasize, those who kind of indulge in these positive fantasies, that they do not manage to bring up the energy to reach these positive fantasies, and also they are unprepared for the obstacles and for the hindrances on the way to reach the positive fantasies.
Now, past experience seems to matter here. When you started studying this, I read that you said you went deeper. You started to wonder whether positive dreams disconnected from past experience would affect people's willingness and ability to take action. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, very early on, we distinguished between different forms of positive thinking about the future. And one was the positive thinking as it had been in the literature since a long time, which are positive expectations. And these expectations are judgments about the likelihood that certain events will happen in the future or not. So these judgments about the likelihood that, let's say, I will lose so and so many pounds, or that I will get the job, or that I will have a nice evening tonight, these positive expectations and or judgments on the likelihood, they are based on past performance. They are a summary of what I have experienced in the past. So, for example, a student who has positive expectations about having a good grade in an exam is basing this judgment that he will be doing fine in the future on his experiences in the past. So if he's a good student, has a lot of good grades accumulated in the past, then he has good reason to think that it's very probable that he will have a good grade in the future as well. So these are expectations, judgments, and they come from positive experiences in the past. Now, with the positive fantasies and the positive daydream, is quite different. They are not based on experiences in the past. They are actually based, what our research shows, on the needs that we nourish for the future. So when, for example, you make people very thirsty, then they will positively fantasize of quenching their thirst. So the idea really is that these positive dreams and fantasies, they come out of a need, meaning out of what we lack, what we don't have at the moment.
Tell us about your study. You mentioned thirsty, and you and Heather Berry Capps, a colleague of yours, tested where positive fantasies come from. And you initially suspected that they came from physiological or psychological needs. So tell us about the one where you didn't let the students eat or drink for 4 hours before and then gave them salty, dry crackers.
Well, yeah, we thought, you know, a very basic need is need to eat, need to drink, need to sleep. And so we had different groups, and one group were made thirsty, and the other group were made thirsty, but then they could quench their thirst by a glass of water. And then we just measured the positivity of the fantasies in scenarios which they filled out in terms of how positive these fantasies were with respect to quenching their thirst, with respect to drinking water. And we found that those in the thirsty group who had not had the water after being made thirsty, that these people had more positive thoughts about quenching their thirst than in the control group.
Yeah, these studies, they are all very interesting because your findings, they often tend to be counterintuitive. And I really like this study you talked about, this What Gives Your Life Meaning study, where some students got a paragraph challenging them to add meaning to their lives, and others got a paragraph that merely said meaning was important, and then you had them fantasize about a job interview. So what happened? How did this work out for these two different groups?
Right. The people in the group who were told that they have kind of a not so meaningful life, they more positively fantasized about finding meaning in the job, whereas the group who were told that their meaning in life is fulfilled fantasized in a way which was less positive about finding meaning in that new job.
Well, the action imperative seems very important here, that one was challenge you to add meaning to your lives versus meaning is important. And that seems to be important here. A big focus throughout your book, Rethinking Positive Thinking, seems to be how you get people focused on acting rather than lying around and just thinking about how things could be so fabulous.
Right. That's what we learned from our participants in the first study. So, for example, in these first studies, we found the more positively students fantasized about getting a good grade, the less well they did in their exams. The more positively university graduates fantasized about getting a good job, the less money they earned 2 years later, the fewer job offers they had gotten. Or also in the health domain, the more positively hip replacement surgery patients fantasized about an easy recovery, the less well they did 2 weeks after the surgery as judged by their physical therapy. So the less well they could move their joint, the more positively people fantasized about the future, the better they felt at the moment, but the more depressed they got over time. So it seems that the positivity of the fantasies were actually not so helpful for actually achieving the positive events imagined. And then when we looked at what people wrote in these studies, we understood that what was missing from these positive fantasies, which were hurtful for acting, what was missing, that people just did not consider that there are obstacles and temptations and hindrances and relinquishment on the way to reaching the positive future. And then we thought, oh, you know, what we need to do, we should have them positively fantasize about the future because that gives them direction to act. But then we provide them the obstacles that are in the way of reaching the positive future. And the best thing would be if they find their obstacles themselves.
Now tell us how you define an obstacle and why it's so important.
Right. What we then came up with is a concept which we call mental contrasting of the future with the reality. And in mental contrasting, people generate a wish and then they identify the best outcome of fulfilling that wish. And it needs to be a wish which is important to them and which is really dear to their heart. And then they identify the best outcome of fulfilling that wish. And then they imagine the best outcome. Basically, that's what we're just talking about. You know, dreaming about the positive future, about a future that you really wish would happen. But then you need to shift gears, and then you need to say, actually, what stands in the way that I actually achieve that wish and experience that imagined outcome? In reality, what is it in me that stops me from going for that wish and really trying hard to fulfill it? So what is it in me that stands in the way? And once people identify that outcome and imagine that obstacle and imagine that obstacle occurring, they will pretty fast find also the behavior they can exert to overcome that obstacle. And that is actually what we call mental contrasting. So it is identifying the wish, identifying the outcome and imagining the outcome, and then identifying the obstacle in me, what holds me back.
Now, why is it so important identifying the obstacle?
Because identifying the obstacle gives a lot of advantages. One is it gives me energy to overcome that obstacle and go in the direction of wish fulfillment. And then I will recognize what I can do if I imagine that obstacle occurring. Then I will recognize what I can do to overcome that obstacle. And then if I dig deeper to find what it is really in me that prevents me from going for the wish, then I will recognize a lot of impediments in my life. So that impediment, this obstacle, might not be only the obstacle to that wish, it might be also the obstacle to other wishes. So it gives me a lot of insight of what I can do in order to fulfill my wishes and solve my concerns.
Yeah, this is so important because I think a lot of times we want something, and because we haven't done what you're talking about, which is coming up with the obstacle and this form, this whole form of mental contrasting, we can't deal with the obstacle because we have no idea what it is. It's just nebulous. We're out in the clouds somewhere. And so you mentioned this, I think, near the end of the book, that it makes this making your obstacle tangible is really a helpful thing in this way.
Making the obstacle tangible is important because then it will be understandable to me how I can overcome that obstacle. And also it will make me understand if the obstacle is just too costly to overcome, or if it is just not feasible to overcome. And if I understand that the obstacle is just too big, that I don't want to, or I cannot overcome it, then I will either adjust my wish. So for example, if I have the wish of jogging 7 times a week, then I can adjust my wish and say, okay, 3 times is good enough. So not 7 times, but 3 times. Or I can actually delegate the wish fulfillment to a later time or to a different person, or I can let go. But then I can let go from wish fulfillment and finally have a good conscience. So I don't need to drag around all these unfulfilled wishes, which I neither can really go for it and love it and embrace it and fulfill it, nor can I leave these wishes. What mental contrasting really does is it helps me prioritize between those wishes which are dear to me and are feasible and those wishes which are too costly or are not feasible. So then at the end, I will have cleaned up my life in a way to sort of prioritize and really only go for these things which are actually dear to me and which are also feasible.
Yeah, that prioritization thing is really fascinating. And I do have to say, I love the idea. You made me think that, oh, if only you could delegate jogging. That seems like a particularly appealing idea. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. My guest tonight is psychology professor Dr. Gabrielle Oettingen, and her book is Rethinking Positive Thinking, Inside the New Science of Motivation. Now, you bring up something interesting. It turns out that only some students in your research who had mentally contrasted wound up feeling more energized, as you say, and then immediately tried to realize their wishes. And you were saying this before about, well, we have to prioritize which is possible, which is not. And you say that the key in this, who succeeded, who didn't, is whether they stood a good chance of success to begin with. And then, again, going back to past experience, their expectations were based on past experience that they would succeed.
Yes, exactly. And this relates to how big the obstacle is. So if I have very low expectancies that I would actually achieve the wish, then the obstacle will be very high and very difficult to overcome. And so then the chances that I will actually go all the way to wish fulfillment are low, and that sort of can either postpone to a better point in time or I will let go. Whereas if the chances are high, then the obstacle probably will be less formidable, and I can find in my imagery about the obstacle a way to overcome it and to effectively reach my wishes. So in other words, the combination of imagining the future, the positive future, the desired future, and the obstacle which stands in the way in me to actually reach that desired future will give me a good hunch of whether I should actually engage and put all my resources or lots of resources into wish fulfillment, or whether I should better disengage and save my resources for other enterprises which are more feasible, which are more likely to be realized.
Now, you're German and you're in America, and I'm wondering if you see any cultural differences, because I look a lot at probability and risk, and I find that Americans, this is just, I mean, I'm not a huge culture expert of other cultures but and other people, but that we tend to be very airy-fairy about, oh, the world is my oyster, we can have it all, and all of this. And maybe it's also because we're bad at math, so we're not doing so well in probability and predicting risk. Do you see differences between the U.S. and Germany or other countries in terms of the way people are able to be realistic about their possibilities, about what's feasible in terms of a wish or a goal?
Actually, we never tested that, and I think it might be also very difficult to test that, because America, it's so big. And even Germany is big. So we also don't feel that people are realistic and other people are less realistic. You can make people adjust their wishes by doing mental contrasting. So you can change people by just giving them strategies to actually understand which wishes are dear to them and which are feasible, and understand which wishes they should probably better dismiss and happily put at rest. So the idea really is that by doing mental contrasting, and that what we call then also WHOOP, which is mental contrasting with if-then plans or implementation intentions, which is a concept which was discovered by Peter Wolitzer. If you take that strategy, and if you take it on your way through your daily life, then you can foresee better where you really want to put your resources in and where you rather sort of hold back a little bit and get a little bit more distance.
And we will get WHOOP, which is really fantastic. It's so simple. It's really amazing. This is something you came up with, Peter Gullitz, or your husband. But I wanted to talk a little bit more about some of your other thinking, because I think it's really important, especially I love how you said that mental contrasting helps people do something important, which is to disengage on a daily basis when the situation warrants it. Because we have a tendency, we get into something and we think we should just keep going. The sunk cost scenario where we've already invested this much, we should just put more in, and we don't look at, what's the outcome going to be? Are we going to have a positive outcome of this, or is it just going to be more good energy thrown after bad? So can you talk a little bit about that, how mental contrasting helps people disengage when that's needed?
Yeah, mental contrasting is helpful to disengage, because very often we feel we should not, or we cannot, or we miss something out or so. And once you do mental contrasting, then you understand that certain things are just simply not possible, or that certain things you really don't want. And that is very liberating. You understand now. I can't have it all. I can't be punctual and still buy a coffee. Very trivial little things. So, for example, you would like to have a coffee, but then you also want to be in time for, I don't know, some lecture or you want to get in the office in time. So what do you do? So you want to have both, and you get all stressed up because there's such a long line. But if you do the mental contrasting, then you understand what stands in the way that you will be punctual in your seminar. And this line is just too long. And then you know, okay, good, great. Well, this, I will just not make it, so I will get a coffee later on. Very trivial things you can actually clear up with mental contrasting. And then certainly the bigger issues. For them, mental contrasting is really helpful, because you understand what is it that stands in the way. And the nice thing with mental contrasting is that it's a conscious imagery technique, but it has non-conscious consequences.
Okay, but I want to actually backtrack a little bit, because you gave that example of the school teacher in the long coffee line. This is an example from your book, Rethinking Positive Thinking. School teacher in a long coffee line who needs to decide if it's okay to be late for class. So she wants a coffee, She wants to be on time. Can you give us an example? Do work out, you know, what exactly what needs to go on in her head for you know, with mental contrasting, how this works specifically.
Well, let's say, you know, you want to be, you're a school teacher, you want to be punctual in the lecture, but you're desperately, you're really desperate for coffee. And you go to your coffee place and there's this long line and you start queuing and then it moves kind of slow and the watch kind of goes and goes and you feel stressed and you feel conflicted and you want to have the coffee, but you also want to be punctual. And now, wouldn't it be nice to be punctual? You can imagine my wish is really to be punctual and to go into class in a quiet way. Wouldn't it be nice because then I could start my seminar in a kind of productive and calm way. Now, what stands in the way? What is it in me that stands in the way? Is this kind of urge for coffee then? And the urge for coffee in light of this long line. And then you can very easily say, you imagine this urge. Okay, you find the integrative solution when you actually imagine that urge. You could say, okay, no way will I make that coffee line, so I will get a coffee later on. But if you don't understand what is really standing in the way, that this line is just too long, it's just simply too long, then you will queue, and then you won't have the coffee, and you will be late.
Yeah, that's the worst. So this really helps you not have those moments where you end up hating yourself for your decision or your lack of decision, your stasis, just standing there thinking, I've been in so far, I've been in this long, I'll just stay here. And it just is, that's just the worst feeling to sort of come out with nothing. You're still late and you have no coffee.
That's exactly it. So, and then at least you know why you gave up this coffee, because you would have never made it, but you wouldn't have understood it unless you would have done this exercise of wishing, I really want to be in the class, and then what stands in the way is, you know, this long line is just too long, I will never make it, and then you can actually, with a good conscience, just sort of leave it and go for your coffee in the first break.
Yeah, somehow explaining it to yourself that way, it really helps. You're making a conscious decision so you don't feel sort of just victimized by the situation because you're deciding then. And I think that's what's absent from many of our quote-unquote choices, that we don't really make a choice. And that's why this is so helpful. But I wanted to just get into something. You brought up something very interesting, this assumption that people readily generate positive fantasies, but many people are mired in negative ones of making mistakes, of suffering, of feeling trapped. Can mental contrasting help these people?
Sure. It can help them in various ways. So let's say you have positive fantasies about doing well on an exam or so, and then you have the best outcome would be that you feel relieved, and then you imagine the feelings of relief. And then what stands in the way? What is it in you that stands in the way that you do well on that exam? And then you can, very often people identify, well, I feel kind of anxious. I feel anxious to be evaluated, or I feel anxious that I might not be as good as others, or I feel anxious because I have had some bad experience. But this feeling of anxiety, which you then anticipate as an obstacle occurring in the exam, that helps you to prevent the anxiety to actually looming large when you actually get into the situation. And you can actually do a lot about this anxiety if you anticipate it, if you foresee it as an obstacle to doing well in the exam.
I want to talk a little bit about how and why mental contrasting works. And you say it engages both our conscious and subconscious minds, and that's pretty important.
Yeah, well, the imagery technique itself is conscious. I mean, you identify a wish, you identify an outcome, you imagine the outcome, you identify the obstacles, you imagine the obstacle. So that's all conscious. But the nice thing is it has non-conscious consequences, and it has non-conscious cognitive consequences, and it has non-conscious motivational consequences. So, for example, it connects the future and the obstacle to each other so that you cannot dream about the future without that the obstacle sort of pops in. And then it connects the obstacle to the instrumental means of overcoming the obstacle. So then once you understand, you sort of the obstacle occurs in your mind, then the instrumental means are tightly connected to the obstacle. So the obstacle cannot be imagined alone anymore. Immediately, it pops in your mind. Anxiety, let's say, it pops in your mind. Then I tell myself I did so well in the past, or if anxiety, then I do it anyway, or whatever your instrumental means really is.
Now, what's so interesting, you point out that order plays a role in whether mental contrasting is successful, and you initially thought that reverse contrasting, so thinking about what's reality first, and then the dream or the wish, it wouldn't create an association in a person's mind that you need to overcome the obstacle to achieve that wish. But you said putting the dream first, makes the, I guess, I'm confusing a little bit. So can you just explain that to us?
Yeah, right. You would think, it doesn't really matter which order you do mental contrasting, whether you start with the future and then go and think about the obstacle, or whether you first start with the obstacle and then think about the future. But it does matter, and it matters a lot, because only when you first design your future, so you throw the ball in the future, and then you imagine what in your reality stands in the way, what obstacle stands in the way of reaching that future. Only then mental contrasting develops its effect. Because if you switch it, then you first imagine or identify the obstacle, and then you imagine the future, the obstacle loses its meaning. So let me give you an example. So let's say you have a exam or a kind of important meeting to prepare on Tuesday. Think about how nice it would be to be successful in that meeting. A nice outcome would be, you feel kind of relieved. And then you say, okay, now what stands in the way? Well, what stands in the way is that I have a party on Saturday night. That's my obstacle. That's my obstacle to achieving well on Tuesday. Now, let's say you do it the other way around. You first think about the party, and then you think about the meeting on Tuesday. You will think very differently about the party. You will think about how nice it would be to be at the party, and what you dress, and what you bring, and what you drink, and I don't know what all that. But you will not think about the party as an obstacle to the meeting. Whereas if you start with the future of doing well at the meeting, the party is not a fun event anymore. Now it is an obstacle to be overcome on the way to reaching success in the meeting. And now the thoughts will be super different. Now you will think, how could I actually get around sort of staying too long at the party? How should I, maybe I should cancel it. Maybe I should tell my friend, party next week after the meeting. So the thoughts and images around that party will be very different depending on whether I will start with the future of doing well in the meeting, and then suddenly the party is an obstacle, it's an impediment, or whether when I start with the party, it will be a fun event, and then there will be afterwards the future, but it has no connection anymore to the party as an obstacle. So the party only will be an obstacle if it is identified and imagined in the context of the successful meeting on Tuesday.
It's really amazing. And I want to get on to your, move on to your wonderful WHOOP plan for achievement. But first, this is Advice Goddess Radio. My guest tonight is Dr. Gabrielle Oettingen, and her book is Rethinking Positive Thinking Inside the New Science of Motivation. So we mentioned this a little bit more, a little bit before. You talked about implementation intentions, which you call the forging of explicit intentions about how to achieve a wish. And your husband, Peter Galwitzer, did studies on this. And tell us a little bit about this and why it's relevant.
Well, when you do mental contrasting, as we said before, you have non-conscious consequences of the conscious image technique. So, for example, the future and the obstacle will be connected, and the obstacle and the instrumental means will be connected. And then there will be also more energy as measured by systolic blood pressure. But what is important in this context is that the obstacle is connected to the instrumental means to overcome the obstacle. But then, if the obstacle is really tough to overcome, then we showed that if you, in addition to mental contrasting, form implementation intentions, that you have additional benefits. And what are implementation intentions? Implementation intentions are if-then plans in the format of if a situation occurs, for example, if an obstacle occurs, then I will show the behavior to overcome that obstacle. So if situation, then I will, goal-directed behavior is the principle, and now you can apply it to the obstacle. If the obstacle occurs, then I will show the behavior to overcome the obstacle. And that then, together with mental contrasting, is what we called in the scientific literature, it's just a very kind of much too long name, is mental contrasting with implementation intention. For dissemination, you know, to the world, we renamed it and we now call it WHOOP, which is basically an acronym for the four steps. It's identify a wish, identify the outcome, the best outcome, imagine the best outcome, identify the obstacle, imagine the obstacle, and then add an if obstacle, then I will plan. So that's WHOOP, W-O-O-P.
So wish, outcome, obstacle, plan. And this is all in Rethinking Positive Thinking, Dr. Oettingen's book. And I just wanted to go back to something you said. So this is about implementation intentions. If this situation occurs, then I will do this thing to deal with it. And this is something I mentioned in my own book, Good Manners for Nice People Who Sometimes Say Fuck, how important it is to pre-plan for things, because as humans, we tend to be impulsive jerks. And when somebody does something to us, we tend to want to clobber them, and this isn't always effective. And this if situation, then behavior thing is so important, because we aren't ready, we aren't really prepared that well in the moment to deal with these situations that come up. And I think to have that little pre-planning bit in your back pocket is pretty essential for being able to behave at your best.
Exactly. And the nice thing is that in the past research of implementation intentions, most of these studies were kind of fed by the content of the researcher. So that was kind of a paternalistic way of giving implementation intentions. But what mental contrasting really does, it makes these implementation intentions customized. So everybody who has kind of learned about WHOOP can now make constructive implementation intentions for themselves. Why constructive? Because in the if part, you can put your personal idiosyncratic obstacle. And in the then part, you can put the behavior to deal with that obstacle, which you deem most effective. So you can actually take WHOOP and apply it to any wish you might have, to any wish which is actually very dear to you. And then you can have the wish, outcome, obstacle plan, and you can, like that, kind of customize the implementation intention to maximize its effects. And the nice thing also is that if you form implementation intentions, they need to have certain prerequisites so that they are effective. And these prerequisites are delivered by mental contrasting. One is that you really need to be committed or determined to reach your wish. And that is delivered by mental contrasting. So then mental contrasting with implementation intention guarantees that the implementation intentions are also working well. And also implementation intentions hinge on having in the if part a situation which is actually meaningful. And that also is delivered by mental contrasting. And in the then part, it needs to be a behavior which is actually effective. And that also is delivered by mental contrasting. That's the reason why putting these two strategies together in one four-step procedure is helpful, not only for identifying your wish, which might have been latent because you never really thought about what your wish really is, and in identifying the obstacle, but also finding very effective plan to overcome the obstacle towards wish fulfillment.
I just want to remind people, so WHOOP is wish, outcome, obstacle, plan. And you were talking about something that psychologists call being content neutral, and this is very important. So this WHOOP can help with any sort of wish you have, short-term, long-term, big, small, professional, your relationship. And this is something, and I'd like to see people listening do this. You say you'd like people to get in the WHOOP habit, use WHOOP with different kinds of wishes. I'd like to see people use WHOOP daily. Try it for a week. That's my sort of psychologically sticky plan. You can do it for a week. Try it for a week every day. Put it on your calendar, on your iPhone or your whatever phone for a week to do the WHOOP about at least one thing in your life. And I think that people will see that, because it's hard at first to start a habit, but once you start doing it, it's so satisfying. I tried it this week while I was reading your book. And it's really fantastic to do that instead of sort of having this sort of nebulous internalized, oh, I should do that. Oh, that'd be good. You know, it's just really this drawing out all the steps is incredibly, it's hard to believe that it's so useful because it's so simple. But as you said, you touched on something before. I wrote down blood pressure when you said that. This isn't just some other BS, you know, self-help thing. This is actually, you've done, your book is just packed with all the studies you've done. And you found that actually there are changes in blood pressure when you use this kind of thinking.
Yeah, actually, this is very neat because it sort of shows that the effects of WHOOP and mental contrasting are really sort of out of our hands. They are non-conscious, and they are in the direction that, you know, when we feel, okay, now I know how to overcome this obstacle, that the blood pressure goes up, and really sort of that the body provides the resources that are necessary to actually achieve the wishes. And the nice thing with WHOOP as well is that, you know, you do it in the morning with respect to, you know, something which is important for the day. It doesn't need to be a kind of earth-shaking wish. It can be something you really wish for today. And then you go about your business, and then in the evening you think, well, I had a good conversation with my colleague, or you think, interesting, I mean, I just wrote this thing today, or you say, I really kind of worked out today or something. And then you realize, that was the wish I whooped this morning. So it is weird, the non-conscious processes are really doing their job. And that's
yeah,
hard
it is.
To see.
Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. Did you want to say more? I didn't.
No, I'm good.
Okay. You know, I'm reminded because, oh my God, I'm reading all this William James right now and all these researchers who talk about William James. He said, what holds attention determines action. And this is what's so interesting and important about this. I like how you said you emphasized to do some little thing that you want. You know, think about, apply WHOOP to that because making this conscious, making your wish conscious, and articulating it is so important for vetting it It's really something that we don't do. And you say that when we dream about satisfying our needs, we're paying closer attention to those needs as well as to relevant stimuli that might lead to their satisfaction.
Well, there are two things, really. I mean, very often when we generate these wishes are easy, and then we just do it. And that's what William James also alludes to. You know, sometimes you just attend and then you do it. So you see a cake and you do it, or you see a closed door and then you open it. So if you don't need a lot of strategies to actually get through life for the most part. But for some, you do. And these are the more difficult wishes to fulfill. And then you need strategies. And then you need something like Whoop, because you need to actually understand what is my wish. And very often these wishes are kind of latent. And you're not, you know, we are so busy and reactive to our environment that we sometimes just don't give us the calmness anymore to really think, actually, what do I really want? What is it that I really want? Not all these things which people say I should want, but what is it that I really want? What do I want in life? What do I want to do in work? What do I want to have out of my, you know, the relationship with my friends, my family? What is important to me? And once you do that and you take yourself out of the world a little bit, give yourself a calm and do a Whoop like that, you can do it everywhere. You can do it even in the subway, but you need to take yourself out. You can't do it while you do email or something. You need to take yourself out of the world and say, now, what do I really want? What do I really want for today? And then you do a Whoop on that wish. And you will see, this is super interesting. It's like a discovery tour. You will understand a lot more about what you feel passionate about and what keeps you from actually doing that, what you feel passionate about. And by discovering these wishes and what you really want and also the obstacles, that will kind of pull you into life again. It will sort of involve you. It will involve you in life, in work, in relationships, in nature, in whatever, sports, whatever path you go. But it will involve you. And once you involve, the new wishes will emerge and you start moving. So Whoop is a change agent. If you want to have everything the same, you know, then you don't really need Whoop. But if you want to attain wishes which are a little bit complex and which are a little bit difficult to attain, and if you want to get involved and if you want to discover new things in the world, outside of you and in you, then Whoop is a strategy which is really fun to apply. And you can take it as a companion. Actually, we have two apps which you can use as a help to practice Whoop every day. And
tell us what they're called. Give people the name so they can look it up at the. Or is it at the iTunes store?
Well, it's actually on. There's a website called whoopmylife.org.
So I love it. It's whoopmylife.org. That's great.
And here you have everything you have access to. You know, the book, but then also the two apps. You can download the apps, and then there's an audio to guide you through Whoop, and there are the scientific background, and there's some press, and we'll update it. And you can always reach us through that website as well.
And I just found in my week of doing this, I'm normally introspective and, you know, so I'm not somebody who's going around just, you know, shut off from her life. But this really was like a lens and to focus on certain things that I didn't quite focus on. So that was very important. And also, I want to talk about something. We don't have too much time left, but something important. I'm big on the power of negative thinking. And you point out that research finds that people pursuing goals benefit from negative feedback, but people tend to feel threatened by it. They tend to forget it. Even when it's trivial, they try to remember the affirming things. And so you wondered whether mental contrasting would help shelter people from losing heart when they receive negative feedback, so maybe they could take some of it in. So tell us what you found.
Yeah, that's an important aspect. I'm glad that you mentioned that. Now, what Whoop really does, or mental contrasting does, is it shelters you from taking negative feedback to your heart, but it also allows you to process the information that is entailed in negative feedback. Very often, negative feedback has some helpful information on how you can do it better and how you can achieve your goals. But we tend to not hear that information because we might be hurt, or we might be feeling insecure getting this negative feedback. And we did several studies, and some studies show that when you get kind of detailed feedback, which is negative, it's a little hard to cope with, you still take it in. And by taking it in, that's really interesting, you actually do better in achieving your wishes. And then other studies show that your sense of self-competence is not diminished when you do Whoop, and then you get negative feedback. So that is helpful too. And then finally,
I just wanted to ask you, because this is it's a little abstract, to just describe, so how do you use this mental contrasting to not be so wounded by negative feedback, and by to able to listen to it and use the quality stuff in it? Not all negative feedback, of course, has quality stuff. Some is just mean, but when it is, when you know it's probably good for you, how do you, what's the process, if you can lay it out for us in the thinking?
Right, you do a Whoop, let's say, with respect to doing well in a talk, some kind of public situation. This is sometimes really kind of hard. So let's say you do a Whoop with doing well on a public talk, and you wish to do well and to get to get the message across. So you say, okay, it would be great if I got the message across, and then you, maybe the outcome would be, I would feel relieved or so. So what stands in the way? Well, it stands in the way maybe that I'm kind of anxious because of all the evaluations, or what stands in the way that I might not be prepared enough. And then I say, as a implementation intention, or if then planned, if I feel I'm not prepared enough, then I will study until the beginning of the talk, or I will take this evening to study, or whatever. And once you did that mental contracting exercise, when then people come and say, you have really this or the other thing not quite right, then I take it as a message which is not really sort of pertaining to me as a person, but to the task of doing a good talk. So I take it task-oriented, and I take the feedback in so that I can actually then do a better talk the next time. So if somebody says, you could speak louder, or you could just switch the order of your presentation, or look at the people in a more upfront way, or whatever, then I take it as a good feedback, as a constructive feedback, and I learn from it. And I don't take it personally in the sense that he wants to criticize me. So I have two advantages, really. I get the information out, which I can use for the future, and I'm not hurt.
Yeah, that is so important. God, that is just great advice. So I see task-oriented rather than taking it personally. God, that is so valuable. I want to thank you. This has just been a great show. My guest tonight has been psychology professor Dr. Gabrielle Oettingen, and her new book is Rethinking Positive Thinking: Inside the New Science of Motivation. Thank you so much. Very, very interesting show.
Well, thank you for having me. It was fun to talk to you. Thanks a lot.